How do we help patients break out of the lifelong patterns that keep them stuck? Let's start with how we develop stuck patterns in the first place. Here's renowned mindfulness expert, Dr. Tara Brach.
We're all trying to meet needs. We're trying to meet needs for safety, and we're trying to meet needs for, you know, for getting rewards, getting nourished, you know, having connection. And when there's unmet needs, we end up locking into patterns of trying to take care of ourselves that aren't so adaptive. So what might have served us when we were very young, in terms of getting our needs met, no longer serves. And then, but we get stuck in the same pattern. And by that, I mean, it gives us enough temporary sense that we're maybe going to get what we want, that we keep repeating it. And one of the metaphors I like a lot, Ruth, is to imagine that we come into this planet and there are challenges, and, you know, in terms of how to get the love we need or the respect or the safety. And so we put on a spacesuit. And I think of it like these are our kind of ego strategies to navigate a difficult environment. You know, so we learn ways to protect ourselves, and we learn ways to go after what we want to get. And that's our spacesuit self. And what happens is that we get identified with that. We get identified with our habits and our patterns of protecting and defending. And we forget really who's looking through, you know, who's really looking through that mask. And so that's getting stuck, is getting identified with the same thought patterns and habits to take care of ourselves that we've been doing over and over again. And from a kind of neuropsychology viewpoint, you know, the neurons that fire together, wire together, we get hooked on those patterns. Now, the more adaptive we are, the more the discomfort of that will be like a wake up, and it'll say, oh, this isn't working so well. And then we'll learn to try something different. Just the way species that can adapt end up being the ones that, you know, evolve and multiply and flourish. Well, a human that can recognize a stuck pattern and let the friction or the discomfort of that stuckness be a wake up, and then be able to have the resilience and creativity to try something different, is able to get unstuck. One of the things about being stuck is we usually don't like ourselves and we judge ourselves for being stuck. So the first step of getting unstuck is to forgive the stuckness, because it gets locked in, we get imprisoned in it if we've added a layer of shaming. So for instance, if somebody feels stuck in procrastination, and, you know, they, and not only are they stuck in procrastination, but they're embarrassed and ashamed of it because they're not really being who they want to be and they're sabotaging themselves. It's not until they begin to sense, well, that stuckness is coming from a place of fear, or that stuckness is coming from a place of self-doubt, and become very, very kind towards what's causing the stuckness, that there's a possibility of change. So the first step then is to forgive the fact that we're stuck, and then to begin to be willing to investigate underneath the obvious presenting pattern, whether it's a repeating kind of thought or a behavior. What's the unmet need? What's the want or the fear that's driving us, that's keeping us caught? And when we can bring our mindfulness and our kindness to that vulnerability, then we begin to get unstuck. And an example for you would be one young man I was working with who was very caught in very angry, controlling behavior, and it started causing him problems in his marriage, but it also at work, where he'd feel like he had a sense that people would take advantage of him if he didn't, you know, kind of show his strong side. And when he was young, it was his only way to really try to get his way or feel safe or protect himself. He was copying his father, who was kind of a bully. But as he got older, it was maladaptive, but it was a pattern that he kept having to be more than just the boss. He was really bossy and offensive. So for him, first he you know, when he started catching on to really how people were relating to him, he became really down on himself for his anger. So the first step was to say, wait a minute, instead of being down on yourself, if you look underneath it, what's really going on? And when he could get that underneath that kind of controlling behavior was the fear of being taken advantage of, a feeling, it was a young place, a feeling of being unsafe, then he became much more naturally compassionate towards himself. And so he started to learn when he was angry to pause, you know, when he'd feel that anger coming up and he'd hear the stories of they're trying to take advantage of me, he'd pause. It was like a signal to stop. And when he could stop and sense underneath what was going on, he had a lot more choice. And that's where, when I talk about being adaptive, as soon as there's presence, as soon as we can pause, go deeper, sense what's going on, that presence gives us some space for choosing. Initially, when he'd pause, he'd be feeling the whole whirl and swirl of anger, and then underneath that, fear, anxiety. So initially, he wasn't able to be thinking about more choices. And there were many times that because he was in an interaction, he wasn't able to choose wisely. But this was why it was gradual. But over time, he would be able to run those situations in his mind and begin to get in touch with things and stay with the vulnerable place. And that's when he stayed long enough and was present with that young, vulnerable place, then he could begin to find more space, more clarity, and more capacity to make different choices. So it really was something that took months and months. It was not a quick change. And I want to just slow down here, Ruth, and say there's different levels of being stuck. And for some of us, you know, if there's been trauma in our nervous system, the stuck place is coming from a very, very deep, vulnerable place. It's going to need to be revisited many, many times with mindfulness and compassion. So the challenging news is that getting unstuck takes time. And the good news is that it's entirely possible, that, you know, science is giving us so much reason to hope for all levels of woundedness and all levels of being habituated, that it's possible to change, that there's this neuroplasticity. And then if you add to that, that we have now, we're now learning these ways of training our attention that science shows dramatically change the structure and the function of our brain. I mean, that you can, if you learn to pause and begin to name what's going on, just naming it. There's a study from UCLA that shows how in just naming, oh, anger, or oh, fear, there's a shift in the brain and there's a reduction of activity in the limbic system, and there is an increased level of activity in the prefrontal cortex, which means more sense of well-being and balance and executive function, more executive function. So that's just one example of a mindfulness tool of naming that actually allows us to get unstuck. More generally, mindfulness, what mindfulness does is by noticing what's happening in the moment, you're no longer lost in it. So if you imagine an ocean with waves, you're no longer caught inside the waves. In a moment of mindfulness, you're more resting as the whole ocean, and you can include the waves, but you're not being defined by them or driven by them. And that gives us more choice. We can make new decisions in our life that actually lead to a lot more creativity and spontaneity and being unstuck.
Tara used mindfulness to help clients be aware of where they were stuck and to find opportunities for change. For some further thoughts on how to work with these limiting patterns, here's Dr. Kelly McGonigal and Dr. Ron Siegel. Ron is assistant clinical professor of psychology part-time at Harvard Medical School, and Kelly is a health psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University.
One of the things that she's really highlighting is that there's a difference between the desire to change and the ability to change or the strength to change. And where people get really confused around self-criticism or criticizing others is they can both be very motivating in the sense that the harder you are on yourself, the more desperately you wish that you could change. And that feeling bad, that I don't want to be this way, I don't want to have this experience, I want to be some other version of myself, I want a different life. We feel how strong that is, and we think that somehow that energy is the same energy as the energy of change. And what she's pointing to is that, no, actually, that energy is more like a straitjacket or like a suit of armor that actually makes movement and change very difficult. And that self-acceptance kind of, she uses the word space. A lot of people this week use the word space. That self-acceptance puts some space back into the moment, so that change is possible. And when it comes, one of the things that, so I just got off teaching a week in self-acceptance, weekend retreat in self-acceptance. And one of the things that seemed to be really helpful for attendees was to really, again, begin to pay attention to the difference between the desire to change and how that self-criticism strengthens that while at the same time weakening your ability to take action. And one of the studies that I shared that helps make this concrete, it's an interesting study that came out of Yale that asked women how often they had experienced body stigma and shame from others in their lives, parents, doctors, strangers, and asked them, how dissatisfied are you with your body? How much do you want to change your weight or your body size? And there was a very strong correlation between stigma, shame, and the desire to change their bodies. And at the same time, there was also a very strong association with exercise avoidance, that the more they experienced that stigma and that shame, the more they wanted to change, and the more deeply motivated they were not to exercise, because exercising brought up all those feelings of stigma and shame. People will judge the way my body looks. Other people will see me in my body. I'm going to feel like an idiot. And that those two that don't correlate is really important to know. And so you can ask yourself when you're in that self-critical mindset, is this strengthening my desire to change? Okay. But is the energy available to do something? And sometimes it's the only thing that can get people to give it up because people believe it or they believe it's motivating. And just to recognize what a straitjacket is, can be very helpful. And if it's in your head, it's even worse. I mean, I like to talk about that because people can often understand that they've seen it. They know that when their doctor judges them or their family judges them, they can see that more clearly than they can see it when it's self-criticism. And that's why I like to give that kind of example. Because otherwise, the voice of self-criticism, it feels too true because it's in your head. There's, you know, so much we could talk about sort of why. We probably will as we move forward with all of these themes.
I mean, another component of this that comes to my mind is how people are sometimes afraid to give up the criticism, thinking that, oh, well, then I'll just become entirely slovenly and won't work on these issues at all. And just how much data there is. I know Kristen Neff loves to amass the studies in her self-compassion work, showing that, nope, the data always lines up in the other direction, that if you can kind of forgive yourself and get back on the horse, you're much more likely to get back on the horse than if you keep with the self-flagellation.
That's an interesting part of the research, the way self-forgiveness acts as a better motivator and self-criticism. In the next video, we'll look at how a power struggle between a patient's hurt parts can keep them stuck.